From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As an American woman helping to rebuild Afghanistan, Sarah Chase dresses like an Afghan man, has faced down a former warlord, and directed the reconstruction of a village. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Chase about the challenges of nation building. Before becoming the field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society, Chase was an NPR reporter. She covered the fall of the Taliban. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Life of Mammals, the new 10-part nature documentary series by Sir David Attenborough. It begins tonight on the Discovery Channel. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of Cole Porter musicals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. military officials say two American soldiers were killed today in separate attacks in Baghdad. General Tommy Franks told reporters that Iraq will remain dangerous for some time.
I have an expectation that we will see rough behavior in this country for the foreseeable future. We will be up to it, and our people will continue to do their jobs.
U.S. military officials say an unidentified assailant walked up to one of the soldiers on a bridge and shot him dead with a pistol. It's not yet clear what happened to the attacker. In the second attack, a sniper killed a U.S. infantryman in East Baghdad. The U.S., Britain, and Spain will introduce a resolution tomorrow calling on the United Nations to drop economic sanctions against Iraq. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the resolution is designed to help Iraqis get back on their feet.
Lifting the sanctions allows the Iraqi people to engage in normal commerce.
Sure.
To have a normal economy, to trade, to
right.
invest, to work, to buy things, to develop their own economy and develop their own resources.
The resolution would phase out the UN's oil for food program over a period of 4 months. Boucher said Iraq won't need the program once it's selling its own oil. France and Russia have already expressed opposition to lifting sanctions, saying that UN weapons inspectors should first certify that Iraq is free from weapons of mass destruction. The Senate has approved the expansion of NATO, allowing seven Central European nations into the alliance. President Bush welcomed the foreign ministers of the nations at a White House ceremony. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The ceremony took place on the 58th anniversary of VE Day, the Allied victory over Nazi Germany. President Bush said enlarging NATO was another kind of victory, and he thanked the nations for supporting the U.S.-led war with Iraq.
The peoples of Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia have a fresh memory of tyranny, and they know the consequences of complacency in the face of danger.
Mr. Bush said the new NATO partners have earned their place among free nations and that the U.S. will always be proud to call them allies. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The White House.
A federal grand jury in Los Angeles has indicted Katrina Leung on charges in connection with what prosecutors say was her work as a double agent who worked for both China and the U.S. The indictment doesn't accuse Leung of espionage, but it does claim she illegally took secret documents from an FBI agent who was her handler. Prosecutors say Leung had a long-term extramarital affair with John J. Smith, who's now retired from the FBI. Smith was indicted yesterday for gross negligence and wire fraud. In stocks today, the Dow lost 69 points to close at 8,491 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. An Indiana judge has dismissed a lawsuit by three same-sex couples saying the state will not recognize the civil unions they obtained in Vermont. Marianne Holland reports from member station WVPE.
The lawsuit filed by the Indiana Civil Liberties Union tried to force the state to lift its ban on gay marriages. Superior Court Judge S.K. Reed's ruling says state law defines marriage as a union between a woman and a man. The ruling also says Indiana does not have to honor civil unions performed in other states. In his ruling, Reed says one of his reasons for dismissing the case is that Indiana law promotes procreation, where both biological parents are present to raise their child. ACLU legal director Ken Fox says it's time for discrimination against same-sex couples to stop.
Marriage is a civil recognition of that type of long-term commitment and stability, and there should be no restriction on it for persons because of their sex.
The ACLU plans to appeal the ruling. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Holland in Elkhart, Indiana.
Days of heavy rain are flooding rivers in parts of Tennessee and Alabama. The Tennessee River is at least 6 feet above flood stage. Kurt Pickering with the state's Emergency Management Agency says the floods will only add to the costs Tennessee is already facing for tornado damage.
Governor Bredesen put in a request yesterday for a disaster declaration, initially asking for 20 counties. That will go much higher, will at least double.
The flooding has forced hundreds of people from their homes in Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 17 points, or 1.1%, to close at 1489. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Gruber Family Foundation, for support of NPR's international coverage.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her work helping to rebuild Afghanistan, Sarah Chase, dresses as a man, has faced down a former warlord and directed the reconstruction of a village. Perhaps you recognize her name. Sarah Chase is a former NPR correspondent who covered Paris, Kosovo, and the fall of the Taliban. Now she's field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society, which was founded by an uncle of Afghanistan's interim prime minister, Hamid Karzai. The group's mission is to promote democracy in Afghanistan by contributing to the formulation of public policy and the physical rebuilding of the country. Sarah Chase's first major project was directing the reconstruction of a Kokalacha, a small village near the Kandahar airport. Half of the houses in the village were decimated during the Allied bombing of the airport in one of the last big battles before the fall of the Taliban. The goal was to rebuild the 30 mud brick huts that were destroyed and to add something they previously lacked, stone foundations. This required getting stones and getting access to the quarry, and that wasn't easy.
It was a wild story. One day, our chief engineer comes into me and says, there's a problem with the stone. And the problem with the stone turned out to be that the governor's men in arms had blocked our tractor at the quarry and weren't permitting us to get any stone for foundations. Now, the landscape there is extremely forbidding, and about the only thing that there is in plenty is stone, right? But it turns out what we learned as we followed this labyrinth through to its source was that the governor was imposing a monopoly on stone in favor of his brother-in-law and another partner. And so nobody in the entire city was able to get stone, legally anyway, in order to conduct reconstruction. I mean, here you were in a province devastated by 30 years of almost uninterrupted violence and destruction, and finally there was a glimmer of an opportunity to begin a reconstruction process, and the very governor of the province was preventing that from happening in order to corner the market, basically.
Okay, so who is this guy, this governor, who is preventing his own people from rebuilding their homes?
This guy is called Gulagha Shirzai, which means something like noble flower Shirzai. He was governor of Kandahar province before the Taliban, and indeed it's partly because of his governing style that the people of southern Afghanistan actually kind of welcomed the Taliban, because so much murder and mayhem and arbitrary violence and looting took place on his watch that the people were desperate for anything that could impose a semblance of order. And what happened was, as the United States was launching or involved in the conflict, Hamid Karzai, who's now president of the country, was negotiating his way down toward Kandahar. Kandahar had been the stronghold and the real capital of the Taliban regime. And there was felt on the part of the Pentagon, presumably, a need for a military action to put pressure on this negotiating situation. So Gulagha was kind of chosen as a guy who had guns and who could muster people with guns, and inserted with U.S. assistance onto the road to the south of Kandahar. And then what happened was this was a major battle at the airport, which is just south of Kandahar, which was the last stand of al-Qaeda. And Gulagha was involved in that battle. Karzai obtained the surrender of the Taliban and asked Gulagha to remain outside the city. He did not want him to become governor. And what happened was Gulagha invaded the city in order to regain his position as governor. And Karzai, who is extremely conflict-averse, was not willing to have another bloodbath, more Afghans dying, and basically gave in to the blackmail.
And what about the United States? Gulagha had helped the United States take the airport in Kandahar. So did the United States help Gulagha become governor or stay governor?
Yeah, in the sense that the arms that made it possible for him to invade Kandahar had been provided to him by the United States. They continued to provide him with arms after he was inside the city. So they continued to arm him, in a sense, against their other anti-Taliban allies, who were grouped around Karzai. It was a very odd situation. And, you know, to the point, I actually drove into Kandahar with one of Gulagha's soldiers, and I was asking him about this. And I asked him the exact same question after he described, you know, how they swooped down the hill toward the city with all guns blazing and sticking out of their pickup trucks and all this kind of thing. I said, where were the Americans? And he said, oh, the Americans told us to do it. And I was just quite amazed that, in a sense, we were instrumental in pitting two different anti-Taliban groups against each other. What then started to happen is that relationships that are created in battle, in the field, have a kind of longevity, so that as American forces finished their rotation and new ones came in, you know, there was a kind of fraternization, I think, that was going on with Gulagha's people. And so that relationship was really cemented so that, for example, Gulagha's brother is the one who provides security to, you know, outer ring security to the U.S. base at the airport south of Kandahar. That also then means that most reconstruction contracts, the bidding conferences, are actually held in the compound belonging to the brother of Gulagha. And in these sorts of almost accidental ways, this relationship gets cemented, and Gulagha is able to use this kind of support or backing of the United States to further entrench his own position. And I don't think this was a deliberate policy at all. I think it just kind of evolved out of an alliance of convenience.
And that favors that are owed back and forth.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Well, so you've hit on what is maybe a kind of typical problem of nation building after war, which is that some of the alliances that forged during the actual fighting are not the best alliances when it comes to building democracy after the war is over.
You said it. I think that's a really, really major issue that we all need to think about, particularly as, you know, our attention turns to Iraq, which in many ways is a similar situation. And I think that what happens is, because of these post-war situations, almost de facto, the most important U.S. presence on the ground ends up being the military. And that means that everything the military does in its own mission has political ramifications on the ground. But nobody really told the guys on the ground that they were making policy. And so they don't necessarily take in the right information. They don't make their decisions in a kind of political consciousness, if that makes any sense. And what I've actually found with the military is that they, at least, you know, those officers that I've had a chance to speak with, is that they are actually quite open to criticizing themselves and to adjusting their behavior once they realize that their behavior can have such incredibly important political ramifications on the ground.
Well, let's get back to the saga of getting the stones that you needed to build the stone foundations for the village that you were trying to rebuild in Kandahar. You know, you couldn't get the stones because the governor, who's very corrupt, wanted you to just do business with his family's cement company and to not get the stones from the mountains. So how did you get what you needed finally?
Brute force, basically, meaning we argued with him then and kind of cajoled him into setting up a meeting with the local director of mines and industry. And we dragged him out to the quarry and kind of showed him that this was the only place that we could actually get stones and got him to kind of give us a special dispensation. And that after, you know, again, some effort ended up working. Unfortunately, what then happened was as soon as we got all the stone we needed, the quarry operator was jailed for about 10 days. And then we had to also raise a lot of cane to get him out of jail.
You must have felt awful knowing that he was put in prison because you convinced him to give you the stones you needed.
Terrible. We felt really terrible. And it was like one of these situations where individuals suffer in a kind of effort to change a bigger picture. We did get him out and he wasn't mistreated. We were really scared because there are some very bad stories about what happens in the governor's jails, too. And we were growing white hair and were really relieved that he wasn't mistreated in any kind of way. On the other hand, what did happen is he had stockpiled a lot of broken pieces of stone that are good for turning into gravel. And all of that material was bulldozed over to the governor's family's cement factory so that they could use it for gravel and cement. So it was also a kind of major theft, the jailing.
Do you think that the problems you've had in just trying to get stone to rebuild the foundations in the village that you're trying to rebuild in Kandahar, do you think these are typical problems in Afghanistan now, trying to rebuild in the aftermath of the war and trying to build a democracy? Or is this just some kind of unusual story that you happen to run into?
I can't speak very well for areas other than the South, but I do know that there is a Gulaga in, you know, at least five major provinces in the country. And this is how warlords work, is that they use every resource at their disposal to further consolidate their own personal power and their own control over these resources. And that's where I think, you know, being close to the ground in the way that we are allows us to try to provide aid in a conscious way, provide assistance, I don't want to say aid, in a conscious way so that rather than reinforcing a detrimental situation, we're actually trying to empower the Afghan people. And I think that takes being very close to the ground. It takes not hiding behind the kind of fig leaf of being apolitical. I mean, in a way, you can't be apolitical, even in the reconstruction business, because you can actually reinforce something that is against the interests of the Afghan people. So I actually think that this story of ours with our little village is very emblematic of exactly what's the biggest problem in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And indeed, you know, I suspect in Iraq there's going to be a similar version because warlordism is, it's like a new ideology in a way.
Sarah, so how far have you gotten in actually rebuilding the village in Kandahar that you've been trying to rebuild, the village that was decimated by U.S. bombing?
We actually finished building that village. It's done. It was a saga because there was not only the tussle with the governor, but there was also a certain degree of tussle with the villagers who saw us as dollar signs in a way coming out of the sky and who were dealing with us. You know, this is also a country that has had no future for the last 30 years. And so people have a hard time thinking in terms of developing a relationship which will be an ongoing relationship and which will bring them a variety of different kinds of support and, you know, over time. And they were basically negotiating like there's no tomorrow. They were determined to get the biggest, nicest houses they could possibly get from us. And it was a frustrating, I mean, our original intention was to rebuild the houses exactly as they had been. But we discovered that we couldn't actually find out how they had been because we kept being told that they were 9 rooms big with a bathroom in every room and air conditioners and stuff like that. And so we ended up, you know, building pretty standard houses. And they were, to some extent, disappointed because they were hoping to get their mansions. But we did have a lovely sort of epilogue when we were scouring the region for another village to rebuild and stopped a farmer in his field and asked, you know, whether he knew whether American bombs had destroyed anything in that area. And it was not far from Akokalacha. Which is the one that we did rebuild. And he mentioned, he said, oh, yeah, there was one right next to the airport, you know, but some humanitarian organization rebuilt it, and now it's a good Kalacha. And so that was nice.
My guest is Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter who's now the Kandahar field director of Afghans for Civil Society. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter, and now she's working with Afghans for Civil Society, which is trying to help build democracy in Afghanistan and to literally rebuild villages in Afghanistan. Sarah, you are working in a culture where women do not have equal rights, and under the Taliban particularly, they weren't even allowed out in public unless they were totally covered from head to foot, and even then they weren't. They were only allowed out in public under certain circumstances. You basically dress like a man in your travels through Kandahar. Why don't you describe the clothing that you wear?
It's a very loose sort of knee-length shirt called a kameez, and then enormously loose trousers. When I first saw that are held tight at your hips by often a very beautiful, sparkly beaded belt, and when I first ordered my first pair of these, I actually thought they had gotten the measurements wrong. I had thought they had exchanged the length and the width because, honestly, when you hold the thing out, it's basically your two arms outstretched. It's very well adapted to the weather, which is extremely hot in the summertime. Then there's just a piece of cloth that's got this incredible Kandahari embroidery worked across both ends that you can either sort of throw over your shoulders as a shawl, throw over your head to cover your hair if you happen to be female like me, or actually even tie around your head as a turban. And when it started getting really, really, really insufferably hot, that's what I started to do because I just couldn't bear having an extra layer on me. And I actually decided to wear these clothes back when I was reporting, when I went, and it was during the conflict, and I went up from Quetta, where I was based, to Chaman, which is right on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it's an extremely conservative small town. Indeed, it's where a lot of the Taliban came from. It's where a lot of them got their madrasa education. And I noticed that there were zero women on the street. There were absolutely none, and there were no Westerners. And I kind of thought, look, I've got four choices. I can either wear a burqa, which I'm not going to do. I can wear Western clothes, which would be like wearing neon lights. I could wear Pakistani women's clothes, which is what I would wear down in Quetta, but that's like wearing neon lights because there are no women in the street. Or I could wear men's clothes, which, and it's not like I was trying to disguise myself as a man.
It's not Yentl.
Yeah, exactly. But what it was trying to create a kind of optical illusion so that at least from a distance of 50 yards, I wouldn't be gathering a crowd, because that's what would happen otherwise. And it actually worked. And so I continued to wear them in Kandahar when the Taliban finally fell and I went in. And now I could wear Western clothes because there are enough Westerners in Kandahar, but I've just gotten used to it, and it's kind of become my. I mean, I think I'm a bit of a circus freak show there anyway, and so it kind of goes with the territory.
Okay, so you're wearing a turban, you're wearing men's clothes. Do you confuse some of the men who you have to deal with? Not only the men you're working with, the men you're working with in Afghans for Civil Society understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, but you're also dealing with this corrupt governor, and you're dealing with a lot of people. You're dealing with villagers who don't know who you are or what you're doing there until you've had a chance to explain it to them. So do some of them think that you're bizarre being a woman dressing like a man? Gender bending is not... It's not common in Afghanistan,
right? Drag is not common yet. I think I do confuse people, and now, as I say that there are more Westerners and Western women working in Kandahar, I really do stick out. What I hear in the street all the time is people saying "Shazada, Shazada," it's a woman. That's a woman, And now I've taken, I kind of take it in stride and. Kind of wink and say, oh, that's a little boy. That you're a boy. You're a boy. And so I kind of hand it back to them and people laugh and all that. Occasionally people do ask me, why do you wear men's clothes? And I pull out this old saga. Or sometimes I'll say, well, you know what? In America, I wear men's clothes too. So why shouldn't I do it here? And it's just, I do think there's a kind of license that's allowed to foreigners, mm-hmm. Even in very conservative Muslim countries. I've lived in a couple. And as a kind of professional woman, which breaks all the rules anyway, you're sort of treated like a Martian. You're some other object that's allowed to gender bend in a way. And I found this. I lived in Morocco a long time ago, and I would find men would take my hand, which is a completely unthinkable gesture between a man and a woman in a country like Morocco or Afghanistan. But they were reacting to me like to a man. While at the same time, I can go and hang out with the women. So it's actually a real privilege to be a foreign woman in this kind of a country.
Just one more question about being a woman working in Afghanistan. Do some of the men in Afghanistan think that because you're an American woman, that they can hit on you and that that's okay?
Never happened. Mm-hmm. It's never happened.
Good.
yeah, it is, because there again, I think culturally the consequences are so enormous that that's really taboo.
Sarah Chase is the field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel by Tom Robbins, author of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of Cole Porter musicals. David Bianculli reviews the new 10-part nature series by Sir David Attenborough on the Discovery Channel. And we continue our conversation with Sarah Chase. She's helping to rebuild Afghanistan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter who's now helping to rebuild Afghanistan and move toward democracy. She's the field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society, which was founded by an uncle of Hamid Karzai, Afghanistan's interim prime minister. What are some of the changes in the lives of women in the villages that you've been working in the post-Taliban society?
The lot of women has improved dramatically since the Taliban were gone. I mean, if nothing else, they can, you know, take a ride in the horse-drawn taxis into town by themselves without having to have a male escort. They can work as teachers. They can go to school as students. But the Kandahar area, anyway, remains an extremely conservative place. And to some extent, a lot of the strictures that the Taliban brought to the rest of Afghanistan were rooted in the most conservative of the local village traditions of the Afghan South. So what we have found is that although you do see women in the street, and although there are a number of programs that, for example, create places where women can work, we have an income generation project which is based on this very fine embroidery that is characteristic of the Kandahar area. And what we have done is decide to go from house to house. It's like the old putting out system before the Industrial Revolution. We bring raw materials to women in about a dozen houses scattered through and around Kandahar, and each house is a focal point for between, I would say, 5 and 30 women. So we're actually employing 200 women throughout the town. And we've been, you know, just amazed at how strong the constraints remain on women in the Kandahar area. And by we, in particular, I mean myself, who has lived in a number of other Muslim countries, and our director of women's programs there, who is an Afghan American, who was born in Afghanistan, and even she has been completely shocked to find how stringent the restrictions remain on women. And so what we're trying to do, this is a very popular program because we're not breaking the rules and because we're not asking, you know, we're not fomenting revolution quite yet, you know. So what we hope to do is to be able to piggyback other activities on this income generation project. One of them that we've already started is simply a neighborhood discussion group. And even that, in one of our neighborhoods where we first proposed to do this, you know, we asked some of our women, well, what if we held a tea once a month and just had a social event for all the women in the neighborhood? And they kind of looked at each other nervously and said, nope, we wouldn't have permission to do it. We can only see other women for weddings and funerals. And this turned out to be the home of one of our drivers, and we turned to him and, Ali Ahmad, is this true? And he said, look, I know my wife's father and I know her brother, but I don't know her uncle. And so I won't let her go to her uncle's house. Why should I let her go to some stranger's house for a tea? We have found neighborhoods where we could do this that were slightly less conservative. And it's just been an extraordinary, again, we're kind of feeling our way, but it's been an extraordinary experience to bring 30 women together and start talking about the issues that really determine their lives.
Is there still a lot of violence in Afghanistan now? You read in the newspapers about continued attacks from Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. Do you feel that violence in Kandahar?
We feel in Kandahar a distinct uptick in extremist activity since about January. Hmm. I mean, it really is noticeable, both in terms of threats. For example, the old technique of leaving what are called night letters in mosques has started again. These are letters that are threatening to people who work with the Americans or work with the new government, threatening to people who send girls to school. One of our families of women who work in our income generation project took their girls out of school because of some of these letters. There are almost, I would say certainly weekly, if not more often, events like, you know, a rocket shot off somewhere to somewhere, you know, usually random. There was an extremely gruesome assassination of an International Red Cross worker just north of Kandahar in a really classic extremist kind of setup where about 30 former Taliban ambushed, you know, blocked off a road, pulled aside the first foreign car they found, radioed for instructions, and killed the one foreigner in the cars. That said, I think it's not like working in Sarajevo during the war or something like that. It's not. I think the reaction on the part of the international humanitarian community has been a little bit excessive. A number have reduced their staffs in the Kandahar area. Some have closed entirely, and I actually don't think that's warranted.
Mm-hmm. Did the war in Iraq penetrate the consciousness of the villagers that you're working with in Afghanistan?
Not really. Not as much as one would have thought from, you know, a U.S. perspective. It turns out that people in post-conflict societies are really self-absorbed. I mean, they're really concerned about getting their own lives going again. They also have long memories in Afghanistan, and they do remember that when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein applauded. And so that reduced the amount of sympathy that there might have been for the Iraqis. I think it's also a really telling point that, you know, here is Afghanistan is an extremely conservative Muslim country that was not opposed to the U.S. Invasion of Iraq. And the real concern that I felt on the ground was that the U.S. attention would turn so quickly away from Afghanistan just at a moment when U.S. people on the ground were starting to get enough of an understanding to really begin to do a good job there. I mean, it really took a year and a half for Americans to become familiar enough with Afghanistan and with the conditions there for their activities and actions and assistance and intervention to make a positive difference. And so Afghans were really worried, oh my God, they're going to leave us, and then where will we be?
Well, has that happened? Do you feel that a lot of American attention has been diverted from Afghanistan to Iraq?
I think that's really happened. You can feel it in Washington. In other words, when we have to approach USAID in Washington, we find that all of the people we had been working with have been moved over to Iraq. It's very visible in terms of the quantity of assistance that's reaching Afghanistan. I mean, you know, there's just money that was supposed to be earmarked for Afghanistan has been set aside and is now probably on its way to Iraq. On the ground, you don't feel it as much because people who are stationed in Afghanistan are preoccupied with Afghanistan. And so there you do still feel the attention on the ground.
You left journalism. You left your position as an NPR reporter to do this aid and democracy building work in Afghanistan. Why did you leave journalism?
I had felt all the time that I was working in journalism, this issue of how much good are you doing, you know, and especially reporting from Paris, I remember thinking sometimes, golly, my job is to entertain, you know, intelligent and well-to-do Americans with the foibles of intelligent and well-to-do Europeans, you know. I mean, on down days, sometimes I would think that, and kind of would keep myself going by saying, well, just being a foreign correspondent is a kind of sedition, I think, in America. Just keeping other countries on the map in America is a really valuable thing to do. But there was always this kind of desire to participate in some way or to, you know, kind of do something rather than only observing. But nothing quite felt right because the thought of kind of joining the international humanitarian industry, which it is sort of, didn't quite feel right. And what happened in this case was just, it was just a fluke. I mean, it fell into my lap and it was so perfect. It was so right. I was leaving the area. I had had a pretty long rotation, about 2.5 months, and I was saying goodbye to sort of favorite people and good sources and things like that. And one of them was the uncle of the Karzais, whom I had interviewed a couple of times only, but they had each time been really, really insightful interviews. I mean, he really was able to give me a a kind of grasp of what the situation meant that I hadn't gotten elsewhere. And I really like him. He's intelligent. He's very insightful, but never too negative, you know. And as I, you know, we had dinner, and as I left, he just looked at me and said, "Wouldn't you come back and help us?" And it was like, it was sort of the clarion call. And I think the other factor really is these Karzais, whom more than any other political figure that I've encountered in any other post-conflict society, or even in America, they move me. Because I really feel like they are doing everything they can for the good of their people, and it's not a personal agenda. And I just haven't seen that anywhere else. And it felt like, you know, if you've been offered the opportunity to take part in this struggle this way with these people, you just can't turn it down.
Well, Sarah Chase, thank you so much for telling us a bit about the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Sarah Chase is the field director of the Kandahar branch of Afghans for Civil Society. She's a former NPR reporter. A new documentary about her called Life After War has been showing on the film festival circuit. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews Cole Porter musicals now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. During the Depression, World War II, and the Cold War, the movies responded with both political satire and sheer escapism, and sometimes something deeper. One of the people who did all of the above was Cole Porter. 5 movie musicals with Porter scores, made between 1940 and 1957, have just been released on DVD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
We usually think of Cole Porter as a Broadway composer, but he started writing songs for Hollywood movies as early as 1929. The first movie adaptations of his Broadway shows kept only the most popular of his songs, like You're the Top and I Get a Kick Out of You from Anything Goes. Later, the scores for 2 of his biggest Broadway hits, Kiss Me Kate and Silk Stockings, remained largely intact. These 2 films, and 3 movies for which Porter composed original scores, have just been released on DVD. Broadway Melody of 1940 stars Fred Astaire and the athletic tap dancer Eleanor Powell, a superstar of the late 1930s and early 40s, with George Murphy, long before anyone would have guessed he'd become a senator from California, and the Wizard of Oz himself, Frank Morgan. One of Porter's most hypnotic songs, I Concentrate on You, was written for this film. The most ambitious number is Begin the Begin, a song Porter had written 5 years earlier for a flop called Jubilee. It's one of the glitziest numbers ever filmed, using a glass dance floor, gigantic mirrors, and vast gauzy curtains. A documentary on the DVD calls this the largest set for any musical number ever filmed. But the most magical moment comes when Astaire and Powell, who hardly even touch, simply come strolling in. My favorite number, though, is Astaire and Murphy in a novelty song called Please Don't Monkey with Broadway.
Whoa. Glorify 6th Avenue and put bathrooms in the zoo, but please don't monkey with Broadway. Put big floodlights in the park and put Harlem in the dark, but please don't monkey with Broadway. Though it's tawdry and plain, it's a lovely old lane full of landmarks galore and memories gay. So move Grant's tomb to Union Square and put Brooklyn anywhere, but please, please, I beg on my knees, don't monkey with old Broadway.
The best of all the Porter movies should have been Kiss Me, Kate. Too bad the censors got a hold of it, so some of Porter's most risque lyrics had to be tamed. Evidently, in the 1950s, a Hollywood movie couldn't refer to the recent Kinsey report on sexual activity. So Porter's witty reference to it in Too Darn Hot had to be changed to The Latest Report. Yet in Brush Up Your Shakespeare, sung by Keenan Wynn and James Whitmore as two gun-toting, bard-quoting, shoe-tapping hitmen, one of Porter's raunchier lyrics slipped past the censors. I guess they hadn't brushed up on their Shakespeare quite enough.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow.
If your girl is a Washington Heights dream,
treat the kid to a Midsummer's Night dream.
If she fights when her clothes you are mussing,
what a clothes much ado about nothing.
If she says your behavior is heinous,
kick her right in the
Coriolanus.
Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all kowtow.
The best dance number in Kiss Me, Kate is From This Moment On, a song that was dropped from an earlier Porter show. Young Bob Fosse was encouraged to choreograph his own steamy duet with Carol Haney. So this may be the earliest film record of Fosse's inimitable style. High Society, a movie version of the Philadelphia Story, Philip Barry's satire on the American class system, starred Grace Kelly in the role created by Katharine Hepburn, and teamed Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby for the first time. Though High Society is rather bland as satire, Porter's songs are tuneful, touching, and funny, including his last number one hit, True Love, sung by Crosby and Kelly, Sinatra and Celeste Holm singing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?, and Sinatra and Crosby's Well, Did You Ever?, another song written for an earlier show. The setting is now the Newport Jazz Festival, which is a great excuse for Cole Porter to write a couple of songs for Louis Armstrong. The more frivolous Les Girls, directed by George Cukor, stars Gene Kelly, but the British comedian Kay Kendall, the personification of droll, steals the picture as the girl in Kelly's trio who has written a tell-all memoir. Kendall died of leukemia only 2 years later. One of Fred Astaire's last romantic leading roles was in Silk Stockings, a Cold War musical satire based on Ninotchka, Ernst Lubitsch's great 1939 screen comedy, with Greta Garbo as the Soviet agent who succumbs to the charms of Paris. Astaire gets to sing one of Porter's best late songs, All of You. He plays a producer, so even in a love song, Porter has him figuring percentages.
I love the looks of you, the lure of you. I'd love to make a tour of you. The arms, the eyes, the mouth of you. The east, west, north, and the south of you. I'd love to gain complete control of you and handle even the heart and soul of you. So love at least a small percent of me do. For I love all of you.
Director Ruben Mamoulian also gets memorable comic turns by Peter Lorre as a Russian envoy and Janice Page as America's swimming sweetheart, a swimming star who comes to Paris to play her first serious role on dry land in a movie based on War and Peace. What do you think of Tolstoy? A reporter asks her. We're just good friends, she answers. Her number with Astaire, Stereophonic Sound, is Porter's satirical take on Hollywood's attempt to lure customers away from their TV sets. Even with Baudelaireized lyrics, it's a comic gem. Hollywood didn't always give Porter the respect he deserved, but his songs still make these movies among the most entertaining ever made.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new DVD set of Cole Porter musicals issued by Warner.
Today, to get the public to attend a picture show, it's not enough to advertise a famous star they know. If you want to get the crowds to come around, you gotta have glorious technicolor, breathtaking cinemascope, and stereophonic sound. If folks today could witness Valentino in the Chic, they never would appreciate this lover boy's technique. If you want to hear applauding hands resound, you gotta have glorious technicolor, breathtaking cinemascope, stereophonic sound.
The customers don't like...
Coming up, David Bianculli reviews Sir David Attenborough's new nature series. This is Fresh Air. Sir David Attenborough, who worked on his first nature documentary for England's BBC nearly 50 years ago, is still at it, and according to TV critic David Bianculli, still turning out informative and entertaining masterpieces.
I've always thought that the very best teachers, the ones you not only remember from high school or college, but the ones who influenced your tastes, your passions, and your life, are the ones who had two great gifts. First, they knew their subjects cold, so well that they could go on and on about them for hours without referring to a single note. Second, they had a passion for their subject that was so obvious it was infectious. Sir David Attenborough, on television, is that kind of teacher. His latest documentary miniseries, Life of Mammals, begins tonight on the Discovery Channel. The cable network has imported this latest production, which is great news, but is televising it in inconvenient doses, which isn't. At first, Discovery Channel was going to show only 6 hours of the 10-hour Life of Mammals, 3 hours tonight, three more tomorrow night. Then it decided earlier this week, probably after a lot of critics and other Attenborough fans complained in advance, to show the whole thing. The remaining 4 hours are shown over as many nights next week. Hardcore fans with DVD players can, and maybe should, merely wait until next week when the complete Life of Mammals goes on sale. It's even letterboxed, while the Discovery Channel shows it in the regular square dimensions of pan and scan. Even so, it's hard to complain about the way a network presents something when what it's presenting is this superb. If you've never seen Attenborough in action, that means you've missed some of the best nature series of the last 30 years. Life on Earth, The Living Planet, The Trials of Life, and the more recent Secret Life of Plants and Life of Birds. Quite simply, he makes the best TV shows on the planet about the planet. With each documentary, he uses the latest technology to capture images no one ever has before. And lots of the time, he's right there with the animals, whispering like a golf commentator as he talks about them from only a yard or two away.
Their eyes are more sensitive than ours, but neither they nor I can see these lights. They're infrared and visible only to our special cameras.
Lions hardly ever roar during the day. It's very much a nighttime thing. And now in the darkness, there are a number of them roaring just around here. There are two I know within 3 or 4 yards of where I am now. And there's a third, perhaps 20 yards over there, though it's difficult to tell because it's pitch black, except for just a faint moonlight. The three of them belong to the same bride, and they're communicating telling one another where they are. Those are not aggressive roars. They are communication roars. But they are quite enough to chill the blood in the blackness of the night.
Attenborough seems to know everything and enjoy it even more. His grin is dazzling as he swims with sea otters, boats alongside blue whales, and wades with manatees. He even stands in an African forest and cries wolf, imitating the howl of a wild dog and letting it echo through the hills. Cameras are placed next to some of those wolves, who are observed listening to Attenborough's call and then responding to it. The first two howls you're about to hear are from the host of Life of Mammals. The rest are not.
If animals are to work in a team, they need to be able to communicate with one another. And sometimes it's possible for you to communicate with them. Oh!
How about that? Sir David Attenborough is nearly 80 now, yet he approaches nature like a kid on his first walk through the woods. And all the while, without being obvious about it, he underscores the amazing interconnectedness of nature and the fragility and bravery and majesty of life itself. Life of Mammals is beautiful to look at, important to think about, and impossible to forget. Whether you see it on the Discovery Channel or next week on BBC Video's DVD set, you must see it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. David Attenborough's Life of Mammals begins tonight on the Discovery Channel. Oh. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Odd Girl Out by Rachel Simmons, about the hidden culture of female bullying and cruelty among girls and how people can help. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Composer Burt Bacharach turns 75 next week. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Bacharach and lyricist Hal David. There's a new Broadway review of their songs. Also, Martin Short, his primetime Glick show, has just begun its third season on Comedy Central, and he's starring in the L.A. production of The Producers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.